Hello, listeners. I'm Scott Bland, and welcome to a special edition of Politico's Nerdcast. Every so often, there's a story at Politico that is just totally, completely bonkers. And we have one of those today, and that's why we are bringing it alive to you as a bonus episode. I'm here with my colleague, Elizabeth Ralph, who's deputy editor at Politico Magazine. Elizabeth, welcome.
Scott, good to be here. Thanks.
So tell us what you've got for us today.
Let me describe a scene for you. So it's Cuba. It's 1964. It's the height of the Cold War. And the world has basically been glued to what's going on with the U.S. and Cuba since the Cuban Missile Crisis, which almost set off a nuclear war. You with me so far?
I am with you. I'm on the edge of my seat. The stakes are high.
Right. So against this backdrop, there's this journalist for ABC News. Her name is Lisa Howard, and she's in Havana. She's just come back from a night out in Havana to the Hotel Riviera where she's staying. But when she enters the lobby, there's a soldier waiting for her, and he tells her to go up to her suite. She goes up, she showers, she dresses, she puts on makeup, and she waits. And she waits. And she waits. She's there to meet with one of America's biggest Cold War antagonists, basically like the most major news story at the time, Fidel Castro. But she gets tired of waiting. She washes her face. She changes into her PJs, and then she hears a knock at the door. I'll let the writer of this great story pick it up here.
Right. Well, Fidel Castro, of course, is famous for keeping people waiting. But most people who he kept waiting never complained to him about it. She opens the door, and she says, "You may be the prime minister of Cuba, but I'm a very important journalist, and you've kept me waiting." And it's basically she slams the door and walks away, and Fidel kind of opens the door and stands there and says, "I think Lisa Howard has kicked us out."
Wow. All right.
That's Peter Kornbluh. He's the author of the Politico magazine story. Peter's been studying and working in Cuba for years. He basically makes a living finding secret documents about the U.S.-Cuba relationship, declassifying them. And he unpacked this amazing tale, which I had the chance to talk to him about.
All right. I will let you and Peter take it away.
Today, very few people have heard the name Lisa Howard, but she was a fixture on TV in the 1950s and 60s. Tell me a bit about her background and how she got her start.
Well, her real name was Dorothy Jean Guggenheim. But when she went to Los Angeles to be an actress at age 18, she changed her name first to Liza Howard and then to Lisa Howard. And she rose to kind of mid-level prominence on the TV circuit and kind of B-rate movie circuit when she was young in the early 50s. She was dubbed by people today the First Lady of Sin because she was always playing a murderess or a temptress or a seductress or a thief. Another of the tabloids suggested that she was a magnificent menace because she was attractive on television, always the femme fatale. She was an actress. She earned a reoccurring role in the famous CBS soap opera, The Edge of Night, the role of Louise Grimsley. People knew her as a soap opera star. But as one of the magazines pointed out, she was the sensitive intellectual type who said she was going places. And in fact, even though she was a blonde bombshell and a quite successful actress, she just gave it all up because she really did want to do serious work in the world. And remember, this is the late 50s and the early 60s. There were no women in television journalism. There were no women in politics, really, except for political wives, the wives of politicians. And she, as she would tell her audiences, wanted to be there when history was being made. And if she couldn't be a politician, she could be a reporter covering political events and historical events and major things happening in the world. And she literally just willed herself, without any background or training, into being a prominent journalist. She abandoned her acting career, picked up a microphone, started reading what she needed to read to ask the proper questions, convinced a radio network, Mutual Broadcast Network, to give her a chance, and started covering the 1960 Democrat-Republican conventions. She scored major interviews and earned a place in journalism, particularly when she talked Nikita Khrushchev into giving her his first interview with the Journalist of the West.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. That seemed to be the big scoop that really made her name. Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev How'd she get that interview?
You know, she set her sights on getting the interview, the get. And part of what defined her was her tenacity. She just wouldn't take no for an answer. She was very scheming, and she'd do what it takes. And the story goes that she kind of melded into a crowd in front of the Soviet embassy and waited for Khrushchev to come out and just kind of like waylaid herself into his entourage, convinced him that this was his opportunity to talk to the American public. He did give her the first interview he had given to a Western journalist. Lisa Howard's scoop with Khrushchev caught the attention of executives at ABC News.
Did ABC have any other female political correspondents at the time?
ABC had no other full-time female correspondents at the time.
Wow.
They had some part-time people. They certainly had women doing various kind of fluffy pieces on the news, the weather, fashion, but nobody who was serious. And they liked her. She was very presentable. She was incredibly photogenic. Mm-hmm. She was very articulate. And they decided that she would be perfect for a kind of mid-afternoon serious news show aimed, as they put it, towards women by a woman. And they called it Lisa Howard and News with a Woman's Touch.
Oh, my God.
Sponsored by Purex. So, and that's how she became the very first female broadcast journalist to anchor her own serious news show.
Major Guevara, since the success of the revolution, the Cuban economy, according to all reports, has seriously deteriorated in every sector. Industrial output, the vegetable crop, the sugar harvest last year, which hit a low of 3.5 million tons. How do you account for this economic regression?
La pregunta es una afirmación.
I was fortunate to be able to read some of her fan mail. And one of the letters that struck me the most was a woman who wrote in about the fact that her daughter, who was a teenager, had been watching Lisa Howard on television. And the mother was struck between the difference between the way Lisa Howard asked questions and the way some of the other, you know, more bimbo-esque women on television news asked questions. You know, they weren't serious people, and Lisa was serious. And she wrote to Lisa Howard saying, "You know, my daughter is watching you. It is so nice that you are asking articulate and sophisticated questions. Like you, my daughter is attractive, but she doesn't have feathers between her ears, and you are setting a model for her future." And I think that's really what Lisa Howard meant to a lot of women and young women across the country at the time. And hers was the first face to be beamed into the living rooms of American homes on a daily basis. When she would score a big news piece, she'd also be able to get on the evening news at times. And she did these specials as well, including the two that she did on Cuba.
So in 1963, Lisa Howard is anchoring her own show. And there is a big news story that everyone wants to cover. It's the hottest spot in the Cold War. It's Cuba. Tell me a little bit about the background. What's happening then?
You know, in the early 60s, this was the most dynamic period of the Cold War in our region. It starts with the 1959 Fidel Castro-led Cuban Revolution, which kind of changes the whole dynamic of U.S. relations with Latin America. By 1960, a year later, Dwight Eisenhower has given the green light to the CIA to overthrow Castro through a paramilitary invasion. John Kennedy inherits that plan.
There will not be, under any conditions, be an intervention in Cuba by United States Armed Forces. And this government will do everything it possibly can.
And gives it the green light, and it fails.
Meet its responsibilities to make sure that there are no Americans involved in any actions inside Cuba.
It was known as the Bay of Pigs,
yeah,
the perfect failure, a CIA-led paramilitary invasion of the shores of what the Cubans call Playa Girón. Castro's Air Force was able to attack, sink the ammunition ships. His militia was able to defeat this exile brigade in less than 72 hours. And that's where we were when Lisa Howard decided that Cuba was the biggest story of all, and the person that nobody had heard from was Fidel Castro. And so she had been trying to get an interview with him since 1960. She stepped up her efforts just days after the missile crisis ended and finally got a visa to go to Cuba in the spring of 63.
So she waits around Havana, hoping to get an interview with him. And eventually, he agrees, and he shows up at the Hotel Riviera nightclub at midnight, and they talk for hours. Tell me what they talk about.
Lisa Howard and Fidel Castro sit down in this nightclub, this lounge at the Havana Riviera Hotel, formerly Meyer Lansky, you know, hotel before the revolution. They really bond. She's very articulate. He's probably never talked to a woman who sounds quite like her. She starts talking about Camus and philosophers to him. She's interviewed Khrushchev. He's about to fly to Moscow and spend several weeks with Khrushchev. He wants to know what Khrushchev is like. She puts it to him bluntly, you know, he's a sly old fox and he'll break you off like a twig if it serves his purposes. She starts talking to him about kind of what she sees as the police state that he has created in Cuba, how he's betrayed the principles of the revolution. I mean, you know, nobody talked to Fidel Castro like Lisa Howard, and she began talking to him like this, bluntly, candidly, honestly, from the first minute she met him. But they did get along very, very well, and he actually agreed from this conversation, which lasted over 5 hours till past five in the morning, to come on television, American television, and do an interview with her, which was filmed just a couple of days later.
Here is reporter Lisa Howard.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We thought you might want to hear some of the events surrounding my interview with Fidel Castro. We filmed the interview on April 24th.
When she interviews him, at the Hotel Riviera, with Communist Party cameras rolling in the Hotel Riviera suite where she's staying, he makes a pretty major admission to her.
Well, of course, the conventional wisdom about, you know, the Cuban Revolution and Fidel Castro was that he was this angry, fiery, bearded, anti-imperialist communist, and that in no way, shape, or form would he ever want to, you know, live peacefully with the giant imperial country of the North, the United States of America. He had just been involved in a set of serious negotiations with a New York lawyer named James Donovan. And Donovan had negotiated the release of the Bay of Pigs prisoners, and then he'd come back and negotiated the release of three CIA guys who were in Castro's jails. And Lisa Howard asked Fidel Castro about this, and he basically said to her publicly what he had said to Donovan privately, which is, we've been able to negotiate this prisoner exchange. Maybe we could build on this to get past the acrimony of the Bay of Pigs and the missile crisis and have normal relations, the United States and Cuba. And of course, this was front page news. Mm-hmm. Fidel Castro interested in, mm-hmm. you know, a parley with John F. Kennedy, interested in a summit with John F. Kennedy, interested in normal relations with the United States. I mean, who would have thought? And when her special interview with Castro eventually aired in May of 1963, it created front page headlines from the New York Times in New York to, you know, the Los Angeles Times in California.
What does she see in Castro during that first trip?
You know, we're lucky to have recovered drafts of a letter that she sent to him, which quoted extensively in the Politico story, in which she really spells out what she sees. She sees two things. One is she sees somebody who she keeps telling him in this letter who's kind of betrayed the revolution and hurt thousands of his own people because of his kind of repressive side. But she also sees a man who's committed to what the philosophers call, you know, the betterment of humankind. And she quotes Kant and she quotes Camus in the letter to him, basically trying to say, you know, one sees in you this great commitment to change history, to change the history of how society is in a positive way. And she noted that, you know, many of his countrymen certainly responded to this, that he had very laudable goals, and that he clearly was going to be a man of destiny. That is, unless the United States destroyed him in its quest to roll back the revolution, what we'd call regime change today. And she commits herself to helping try and keep that from happening by addressing the issue of U.S.-Cuban relations. She says to him at the end of the letter, you know, I'm going to go back and talk to people. And I can't promise that anybody will listen to me, but I will try, and that's the best I can do, you know. And she was a rather influential person, not only because she was a rather big celebrity TV broadcaster, but because she was a very tenacious and forceful personality. And when she wanted somebody to hear her, she made sure that they did. And when she got back to the United States, she really did make sure that they heard the message that normal relations with Castro's Cuba was possible.
And what did Fidel see in Lisa Howard?
Well, we don't have his letters. We know that he sent her a bouquet of flowers after the interview. She refers to them in her letter, and I actually found a source in Cuba who had seen them. And you know, he, I think, had never heard anybody from the United States talk to him who he was having a personal relationship. He had personal contact with. He certainly had heard U.S. policymakers screaming about him from afar. But here's somebody sitting across the table from him. And I don't think he'd ever heard anybody talk to him as bluntly.
She's incredibly directly. Frank with him.
Yeah. I don't think he had heard this candor and this frankness. Mm-hmm. And this kind of level of kind of assessment and analysis shared with him in this way. And of course, I don't think he'd met a news person who was as interesting and attractive as Lisa Howard, this woman in her mid-30s, you know, sitting across from him. And it's clear that that there was a chemistry between them. And one of the things that's in the Politico article is that in one of the drafts of her letters, she writes, on a personal note, I want to say that I know there was something between us. I know we both felt something between us, but it couldn't be realized. I am who I am, and you are Fidel Castro. And at this moment, you know, our personal interaction is not important. But she made it clear that was sad for her, and that she wasn't sure that she was ever going to see him again. But she did commit to working on U.S.-Cuban relations, and in fact, she did end up seeing him again.
So she does return to Cuba. She returns to Cuba a second time in February 1964, this time to film another ABC special. And they finally get to explore some of these personal feelings they have for each other. But it's complicated, right?
It's complicated. That sounds like something right out of a movie title. And it certainly was the way it was with the two of them. She doesn't give up. She goes to Cuba again. She has a whole entourage in tow. A producer, camera crew, and Elliot Erwitt, the famous photographer, is coming with her on assignment for Newsweek to take pictures. She's treated very positively as they arrive, given the red carpet treatment. Of course, the first thing she wants to do is see Fidel Castro.
So your story opens with this scene, and she's in her suite at the Hotel Riviera. This is the second time she's been to Havana. She comes home from going out to dinner in the city, and a soldier is waiting for her in the lobby, and he tells her to go up to her room where she bathes, she dresses, she puts on makeup, and she waits. And she waits for about 2 hours. And then she hears a knock at the door.
Right. Well, Fidel Castro, of course, is famous for keeping people waiting. But most people who he kept waiting never complained to him about it. But Lisa Howard was constantly saying to him, you kept me waiting, you kept me waiting. And finally, there's a knock at the door after she's been waiting a day and a half to see him, thinking that he'd just come running. He is the head of state, of course, and has other things to do.
But she was a very important journalist, as she told him.
She opens the door and she says, you may be the prime minister of Cuba, but I'm a very important journalist, and you've kept me waiting. And then she slams the door and walks away. And Fidel, kind of opens the door and stands there and says, I think Lisa Howard has kicked us out. She hasn't even invited him in yet, but of course she does invite them in. And they have this long conversation about politics, about Kennedy and his death, again about the whole issue of Fidel's authoritarianism, about his trip that he has taken to see Khrushchev since she last saw him. And this goes on for several hours. And then she kind of up and invites his aide, who's acting as Fidel's interpreter, to leave mm-hmm. so that they can have some privacy. And, you know, the moment has arrived. There's obviously been a physical and sexual tension between them since the moment they met. And here they're finally in a hotel room by themselves. And what happens? The most extraordinary thing happens. Fidel, I mean, they do kind of hug, kiss, lie down together. But Castro does this amazing thing that you would never expect from a Latin American man cast as the big macho, you know, comandante. He says to her, I can't really do this. You have done so many important things for us in the United States, and you and I are working on this important project to bring the United States and Cuba together. And if we go to bed together, this will all be destroyed.
Yeah.
He really says, wow. He basically says to her in a roundabout way, the international interests of my country and my country's future are more important than my going to bed with you and conceivably ruining this, you know, political partnership, this back channel effort that we are making together. And he sticks to this. He doesn't take off his clothes. He says to her, look, this isn't going to happen now. Maybe the next time I see you, it'll come naturally. But good night. By this time, it's 6:30 in the morning. He tucks her in and leaves.
For 2 weeks, they travel around Cuba. And they're basically traveling around the Cuban countryside, right? Seeing cattle farms, filming him playing basketball. And this is for the ABC special.
Right. The special in Cuba is going to be on kind of the daily life under the revolution. It was titled Cuban Castro Today. And it was less about him than it was about the Cuban people and the revolution and what kind of lives they were leading. So they follow him around. He goes to play baseball. They go to a bull farm where they have some really interesting interaction and some significant conversations as well. But she's trying to, you know, compile footage.
Yeah. The Elliot Erwitt photos from that trip are really striking because they really capture the intimacy between these two people. I mean, he has these candid moments where they're sitting in a cattle farm looking into each other's eyes. They're laughing. He's looking more tender and relaxed than he ever does in photos. She writes at one point in her diary that he's the most physical animal man she's ever known. You can tell that there's this chemistry kind of simmering between them. And he's still reluctant to consummate their relationship. The night after the second interview, she does another interview with Fidel as part of this ABC special. She says she wants to change into something more comfortable, and he objects.
They had a serious political foundation of their relationship. And when they get to the second moment during her trip in February of 64, where they're alone in her hotel room,
she's asked his aide to leave again.
Right. And he said, no, I can't be without my lawyer. He's basically saying, I don't really want to be alone with you. And then this rather extraordinary moment where he's trying to keep her from disrobing, from taking off her dress. And so he makes a big scene about how beautiful her dress is and he loves her in it and he wants to see her in it. And she says, well, I'm going to change into something more comfortable. And he says, no, I don't want you to take off that beautiful dress. I want to see that dress. And she, you know, true to her personality, just went into the bathroom and
changed
into her pajamas and in a robe.
Yeah.
Comes back out and he's like, Lisa, you never listen to anything I say. Why don't you treat me like a man? You just do what you want to do. And here, you know, the typical machismo of a Cuban leader comes to play, but as well her own kind of determination to be more comfortable. And of course, one thing leads to another and they finally do consummate their really dynamic and complicated relationship. And that's essentially the first thing he says to her. Lisa, this is a very complicated situation between you and me, but that makes it more interesting.
The third time Howard travels to Cuba, she doesn't travel as a journalist.
This is the big reveal in the story. She has managed to get a direct message from Fidel Castro into the hands of Lyndon Johnson using the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, with whom she knows very well from New York politics, as her kind of intermediary. I mean, the backdrop to this, of course, is that she has managed to turn her apartment into a secret communications hub between the United States and Cuba. And she has worked very hard to get the two sides talking, and relatively successfully. She's gotten U.S. officials involved. And all this is coming to fruition. The momentum is building and her excitement is building. You can see it in the entries of her diaries. Just 72 hours before John F. Kennedy is assassinated in Dallas. And one of the most poignant things for me is to look at footage of Lisa Howard covering the Kennedy assassination for ABC News, and knowing that not only was she feeling what the rest of the country felt, the shock and horror, but she is feeling and understanding that all the work she's done to build towards better U.S.-Cuban relations has completely gone down the drain, that along with Kennedy's death has come the death of this secret project that she's been working on. What to do? She doesn't give up. She goes to see Stevenson in June 5th, 1964, at his apartment at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. She hands him a typed up, what's called verbal message through Lisa Howard from Fidel Castro to Lyndon Johnson, in which says essentially this: "We were engaged in secret talks with Kennedy. We would like to continue those talks. I understand it's a political year. If you want to be bellicose and even attack me, as long as you let me know that it's for political reasons, I will not retaliate or respond."
Which is a really remarkable promise.
Absolutely. He's basically saying there will be no, you know, provocation on our side during 1964, because we would like to actually continue these talks for better relations. And we understand how politically sensitive the situation is in 1964 with Lyndon Johnson running against Senator Barry Goldwater, you know, the Ronald Reagan of his day in 1964.
So he essentially said, if you need to take an act of aggression, as long as you tell me about it, I'll understand.
This is exactly what the message says. Now, this message, we know, is a message that she types up after this conversation she has with him in her hotel room in Cuba before she leaves.
Yeah.
They talk about the
deal.
During her second trip, they talk about this deal that he would like to make. He will agree to stop supporting the export of revolution in other parts of Latin America. You know, he may or may not do something with the Russians. The United States would cease to support the violent exile militants who are committing acts of sabotage and terrorism against Cuba. They would keep things calm throughout the 1964 election year and hopefully then have a dialogue. Plus, they should have this dialogue using Lisa Howard, a trustworthy intermediary, as their interlocutor. This is basically what the message says. She spends all spring trying to get this message to Johnson directly. She feels like she should hand it to Johnson, that that's what she's been entrusted to do. And at the White House, at the National Security Council, McGeorge Bundy doesn't want her to get in to see the president. He thinks she's going to eventually go on television and break the story of the secret talks with Cuba because she's going to know both sides of it. And he doesn't want her to be able to say, I met with Lyndon Johnson and gave him a message from Fidel Castro. So he tries to get his young aide, Gordon Chase, from the National Security Council to get the message from her, and she won't give it to him. She doesn't believe it'll ever get to Johnson that way. And eventually she turns to Adlai Stevenson. She gives him the message on June 5th, 1964. Then what happens? Almost immediately, she decides she's going to go to Cuba and tell Fidel Castro that this has been accomplished.
Does she decide, or do they send her there?
No, she goes, but she's been told, presumably by Stevenson, that the United States has a message for Fidel. They've just received one from him, but now they have a message for him. And this message is that they've picked up intelligence that he's threatening to shoot down U-2 reconnaissance planes that routinely fly over Cuba since the days of the Cuban Missile Crisis to assure that there are no missiles being restored, no missile bases being built. Either somebody in the room or somebody on a telephone intercept, you know, has said something about Fidel threatening to shoot down these planes. And it's 1964. It's an election year. The Johnson administration doesn't want to have to deal with any provocation like that, and they want to get the message to him that he better not tinker with the planes. No shooting at them, no shooting them down. And they entrust this message to her. And she goes down. She's, again, given the red carpet treatment. Fidel puts her up at a protocol house with a butler and a chef and a driver, a car and driver, one of these big mansions that was abandoned after the revolution.
Socialism for you.
Yeah. In contrast, he spends the night with her on his decrepit yacht, which is this little wooden boat with a non-functioning bathroom and shower and bobbing around in the Bay of Pigs. And they spend the night together. And again, they talk and talk and talk. And as she puts it, you know, it's the icing on the cake. Their physical relationship, but their intellectual relationship is more important. And she talks to him about this issue of shooting down the planes. And he says, tell them I won't do anything. I'm going to be completely cooperative and supportive for all of 1964 until the election. And she runs back to the United States and gives this message to Adlai Stevenson, who promptly passes it to the President of the United States. And I have to say, you know, a fairly significant and dangerous situation is averted, and U.S. officials are breathing easier. They really, when they got this intelligence, we have the documents, they really were worried about this happening, and they tried to find any conceivable way of getting this message to Castro privately. And Lisa Howard turned out to be the perfect emissary. And this is, you know, an ABC news journalist who's basically inserted herself in the kind of secret areas of international diplomatic efforts. And she's become the one person who has connected Fidel Castro's office and the Oval Office. And that is no small accomplishment, undertaken and completed in a very short period of time by a rather extraordinary person.
Peter, how do you know all this?
Well, I started my career at the National Security Archive working on the history of U.S. aggression towards Cuba, the still secret history of the Bay of Pigs, of the missile crisis. When I started, there weren't that many documents available, but my office pushed really hard for all these documents, particularly on the missile crisis and the Bay of Pigs, to be declassified. What I discovered doing this research is that there was a secret file that was still secret of secret contacts between the Kennedy White House and Fidel Castro. And I asked for that file to be declassified under something called the Mandatory Declassification Review Law, which is a regulation that the presidential libraries operate under. It's kind of the Freedom of Information Act law, essentially. And this entire file was released, and in it was all these details about this American journalist, Lisa Howard, and the intermediary work that she was doing, particularly the first trip and the second trip, and her efforts to get Kennedy and Castro together, and then to get Johnson, create a line of communication with Johnson and Castro. And all those documents were there, secret, declassified, beautiful, detailed. I said, this is a story that nobody's heard of. Who is this person? And I tracked down her widower, Walter Lowendahl in New York City, and I said, I want to write about your wife, and this is an amazing history. And it turned out that he had had her personal papers in a closet for decades, and he donated them to the National Security Archive. And we've made some use of them over the years, but the more sensitive kind of personal side of her relationship with Fidel Castro was kept for the right moment. And it seemed like at this day and age, this moment with Raul Castro stepping down and the Castro era starting to fade, that the history of Fidel Castro's efforts and Lisa Howard's efforts, it still has a time of relevance, particularly today when Donald Trump is kind of sabotaging better relations.
Do we know whether her husband ever read the diaries?
I never knew if he had read them.
But he just hands you this trove of amazing
material. There were, you know, boxes and boxes of materials. It wasn't just that there were these diaries. It was that there was boxes of her scripts for her television programs. There were boxes of her public speeches. There were her memos to her superiors at ABC. And then there were several files that related to Cuba. And in those files were some kind of detailed notes and typed up diary entries and an actual physical diary of just her communications with Fidel and with other U.S. officials about Cuba.
The story of Lisa Howard does not have a happy ending. Not for the secret diplomatic channel, not for Lisa Howard professionally.
One of the reasons people don't remember who Lisa Howard was is that she died very young, at age 39. She had been fired from ABC News. And she, you know, really did attach a lot of importance to being a successful professional journalist. And nobody else would hire her after ABC put out the word that she was, quote, lousy, unquote, in the profession. Why did this happen? Well, it really started with her second special on Cuba. She fought tooth and nail and did not give up on making sure that her special, which was called Cuban Castro Today, was not some knee-jerk Cold War kind of anti-Castro propaganda. We have her memos to her bosses about this, her diary entries over what she called the titanic battle that she waged to make sure that every other sentence in the script didn't call Fidel a communist and that didn't dismiss him and didn't just dismiss the revolution as a communist front. She tried to say there's, you know, a reality in Cuba that's much more nuanced and complicated, and we have to show it if we're going to be honest journalists. But her boss was very angry about these fights, and little by little, she was cut back on being used as a journalist at ABC. And then she turned away from Cuba and began a new project called Democrats for Keating. But ABC News was scandalized by her kind of public advocacy and public politics. She demanded that her superiors respect her rights, her constitutional rights as a citizen of the United States to have political views. She said to them, my views are not reflected on my show, so what's the problem?
Mm-hmm.
But they saw a problem, particularly when the White House started calling about it.
Yeah.
And they suspended her from her show for the duration of the campaign in September of 1964, and then they fired her after the election. And she could not get rehired despite many weeks and months of efforts to get rehired.
What happened to the back channel?
When the Johnson administration decided that it was just too delicate to have a very prominent journalist being the main conduit between the president of the United States and Fidel Castro, they kind of ended their communications with her. And that was really a downfall for her. And her professional life went downhill, and then her personal life also suffered. She had a miscarriage. She was hospitalized with depression. And then she kind of forged a prescription for barbiturates during a weekend outing at the Hamptons over the 4th of July in 1965 and changed a prescription of 10 barbiturates to a prescription of 100 and got them from the pharmacy and took them in the parking lot and passed away. And, you know, along with her passed an extraordinary legacy, a legacy of being a pioneering female journalist, controversial, of course, but still pioneering, the first female face to be beamed into the living rooms of America for young women to see and emulate, and also being a pioneering, you know, citizens diplomat, if you will, a back-channel conduit with a passionate commitment to solve the still problematic relationship between the United States and the Cuban Revolution. And the history she created, she would tell her audiences that she wanted to be present and on the spot when history was created. And in fact, she created this history of back-channel diplomacy with Cuba. And it's still a relevant history today. And I do believe that it is an incredibly important part of the legacy she has left.
Peter Kornbluh, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure to bring Lisa Howard to life with Politico Magazine.
It's been a very rewarding journey for me, too.